If Yaco is in argument for petitioners?
Hey, please report, I'm, of course, Roger Yaco, and I represent Mr. Martinez, who is injured in a oil field accident. He was at that time working for a company called Base Well Servicing.
Could you speak a little bit louder, please?
Sure.
Some of us are getting up in age.
He was working for a company called Base Well Servicing.
Thank you.
And he had settled his compensation claim with that company. He settled it for about $50,000. He lost his hand effectively in the accident, lost the use of it. And that's the statutory. He got about his medical and what the statute calls for in terms of loss of hand. There was a third party also operating at the site where he was injured. And was this third party's equipment and this third party's negligence, according to the petitioner, that actually caused the loss of his hand. So he sued, and this is R.B. Tool, the respondent here. A regular third party type lawsuit after he settled compensation against the employer. No one at the trial disputed Martinez's injury. No one disputed that the equipment, which was owned and operated by R.B. Tool, not fairly job site, was the cause of his injury, and no one disputed that the equipment was used negligently and improperly. The only dispute in the entire lawsuit was who was in control of the job. In other words, was there a bar, was Martinez barred by having, from suing his employer under the compensation scheme? Or was he entitled to sue R.B. Tool, who Fitner said was in control of the job? That was the only issue in the case. Everything else was pretty well admitted, or pretty well settled by the time the trial was done. Martinez proved, in terms of damages, about $300,000. That wasn't really hotly contested either. He lost his hand, he was a working man. So he went into the case, having settled for $50,000, and what he was really trying to do was bring his third-party action against the real tortfeasor and collect the balance of the $300,000 from R.B. Tool. What happened in the trial was very strange when you look at it, just looking at the record. The Bates people, that's his employer, came in, testified before the jury, it's all our fault. We're the ones who are responsible for this terrible accident, and we're sorry now. You don't often get that kind of testimony from a defendant in a trial. The reason that they did that, those witnesses, this is what the petitioner says, of course, is because by doing that, only Bates would be responsible, only $50,000 would be paid, and the balance of the claim, which was virtually conceded to be valid, would be borrowed. That is, R.B. Tool would be out of the case, too. There was good evidence in the trial, and good evidence on the deposition of one of the witnesses, that R.B. Tool was actually in control of the job. And to give you a brief idea of what happened, Bates had a pulling unit, which is a portable rig that was on that location, going to pull some tubing out and replace it onto the oil well. R.B. Tool, being a separate corporation, had what is called a reverse unit. Now that is a drilling unit. There's no drilling equipment on the base pulling unit. The reverse unit was designed to drill out a cement plug which had been placed in the hole at some earlier time. It was during the operation of drilling out that cement plug with RV tools equipment that Martinez got his hand cracked. Now, why would the defense witnesses come forward and say, and of course, this is the, what the substance of the written argument that's been submitted to you is, why would they come forward and say, we did, we're the ones responsible? Well, as it turns out, the two corporations are separate corporations, but they have common owners. A father and son that, by the name of Bates, own all of both corporations. As it further turned out, this is not in the record, and perhaps it should have been, but Texas Employers was the workers' compensation insurer for Bates, as well as the general liability insurer for RV Tools. In other words, they were not just...
That's nowhere in the record, though?
Well, I wish it had been, sir. What we wanted to do...
We're bound by the record.
Well, I understand that, sir.
If it's not in the record, don't talk about it.
My position here today is to try to get this court to send this case for a new trial so that these kind of facts can be put in the record. And I think it would be of assistance to the court. I'm not going to rely on a statement like that in this argument. I want to rely on law as I see it, and facts in the record. But my purpose in here today is to try to get Martinez a fair trial back there in Odessa. And in order to understand that, I think the court needs to know exactly what happened in the case.
Where you only want to hear arguments that are based on something in the record. That's all we have jurisdiction over.
Did you make a bill of exceptions on it and offer it that way?
I did, not in so far as the TDIA insurance being a common insurer for both parties. That was not made by way of bill. So I probably should have done that. In any event, I don't think for the purpose of this argument I have to rely on that, because in the record, it's clear that the Bates father and son were the 100% owners of both corporations. Now, they had separate corporations for their own reasons. I'm sure they had good reasons for it. We believe that because they're separate corporations, that of course they should be treated as such in a case like this. The evidence showing RV Tool was in control of what happened out there appears throughout the record. I don't think, I'll use my reply time if this is disputed anyway, but I don't think it will be. The equipment was all owned by RV Tool. The rig that was doing the drilling was owned by RV Tool. The operator, Mr. Story, was an employee of RV Tool, and he was in charge of the operation, removing the drill bit, and remembering it was a drilling type unit. He was in charge of that operation at the time the accident occurred. The the jury found that there was no negligence on the part of RV Tool, and no negligence on the part of the petitioner. I submit to the court it's a proper inference that their real finding was that Bates was responsible. In order to come to that conclusion, they would have had to rely on the testimony, which I mentioned earlier. That is, the Bates witnesses, employees of Bates and employees of RV Tool, these commonly owned companies, come forward and say it was all Bates' responsibility and it was all Bates' fault. At the outset of the trial, we had asked the trial judge to be able to go into these matters. After all, what are you going to do when you lose your case by an admission of guilt on the part of the defendant? You can't cross-examine that defendant in any sensible way unless you're permitted to show the jury a context in which, by which this man, when he admits his fault, is saving these corporations, commonly owned corporations, $250,000. Without having that context to operate in, you simply cannot cross-examine a man who admits his fault.
Let me ask you this. Did you have testimony from Bates by way of bill of exceptions of the settlement agreement?
No, there was a testimony by the lawyer for TDIA in order to explain that the settlement agreement had been made.
We do have the settlement agreement in some form before us.
Yes, sir. It appears in a supplemental statement of facts, the testimony of Alan Paul, attorney for TEIA, intervener in the case.
Of course, that in and of itself is not going to be adequate to show the jury bias and prejudice on the part of Bates or reason why he would testify as he did. Is that not correct?
I agree with you, sir. The heart of the matter...
All right. Did you attempt to get the court, did you ask the court to instruct that under the law an employee cannot sue his employer?
I asked in rather different terms to go in than I wanted to put evidence before the court or before the jury of the settlement that had been made, the compensation settlement that had been made, and to be able to further explain and argue exactly what I just told the court I wanted to. That is, that by apparently accepting responsibility to really save these people what we consider to be $250,000. I asked the judge if I could do that. I asked him before the voir dire, and he said no, and I asked him after that another motion, and he said no. And he said in words to this effect, whatever we have to do, it was not subject to the motion limit, to settlement. But the judge said, whatever we have to do, just keep from talking about settlement, that's what we're going to do in the trial.
Right, I can see what you're attempting to do there, but to show bias and prejudice on the part of Bates, did you show him how he would have benefited by saving employers' casualty or Texas employers in this case? I mean, what inured to the benefit of Bates to give this testimony?
Well, I think that anyone who can avoid a claim certainly gets some benefit, whether you can put a precise dollar value on it, or whether it just means that his insurance is going to get canceled, or if the premiums are going to rise, or whatever.
Well, if
there's going to be some detriment to him if a claim like this is paid.
Well, that's what you're arguing to us now. Do you have anything in the record to show what detriment would have come to Bates had there been a judgment taken against RV Tool?
Not directly, no, sir.
You're just asking us to surmise it.
Yes, sir. What we're relying on, of course, is the Texas rule, which is cited in the brief, Rule 408. We rely on the plain language of that rule, in particular, the last sentence. This rule does not require exclusion when the evidence is offered for another purpose, such as proving bias or prejudice or interest of the witness or party. That rule has been the subject of a lot of discussion, and it's been in this court the subject of a couple of decisions. One is cited in the brief, the City of Houston and Sam P. Wallace. One case in the El Paso Court of Appeals, not cited in the brief, Garza and Waco Scaffold Insurance Company, 576 Southwest 42nd, at page 442, also comes to a similar conclusion that the words of the Texas rules in 408 mean what they say they do. And of course there are some federal cases that have not been cited, but since the Texas rules have changed, they have been imported into the references behind Rule 408 in most of the textbooks. And really what federal cases say is when you have a contest between keeping out a settlement in order to follow the policy of encouraging settlement of litigation. And that's really what the root of the rule is. When you have that policy on the one side and you have on the other side a question of the credibility or bias or interest of the witness, then the better policy is to allow the evidence in and make sure at least that when your jury goes to make a decision, you're going to have all that they need to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses. Without that, you're not going to have much of a trial. So what we wanted to do at the trial, what we're now asking this court to give us another opportunity to do, is we want to say that the same person owned base and RV tool. That the judge permitted us to say in this trial. That was not enough for us to give a context to a jury argument about why they would be admitting fault.
Counsel, did you protect the record? Did you have on the record your effort that you wanted to cross-examine the witnesses or enter their settlement agreement into evidence? Is that all in the record?
Yes, sir. It's in the record on two or three occasions.
Can you tell us where? Tell me.
Yes, sir. The initial motion is in the statement of fact on page 26. That is a reference where it's submitted to the court for entitled under the Texas Rules of Evidence, Rule 408, to submit the jury evidence of the settlement made by Base Well Service Inc. for this plaintiff.
And you got a ruling, you got the trial court to make a ruling?
Yes, sir, the ruling was there was an earlier ruling against them. Yes.
Is that in the record?
Yes, sir. So we tried to do it, and
what are the references you have in the record?
Other references, sir?
Yes, sir.
All right. Then at the end of the case, at the end of the case was a different motion made, which was the subject of another point of error, which was not granted by this court. And then there was a motion for new trial on which evidence was heard and these matters raised once again. Both points, including the point which is not before the court today.
Counsel, you may not understand, but when we grant writ of error, the entire case is up here and all points up here. We grant on points in which we're most interested, but the other points are here just as well.
I didn't understand. I have to be frank about that. And then perhaps I will mention the other point that I wanted the court to take up on. But that, the evidence that we wanted to get in answer to your question, sir, is the evidence that we wanted to get in really not too much. We wanted to get in the settlement. We wanted to have the freedom to argue to the jury that this is what happened. There were two witnesses who gave evidence. One was the RV tool operator. Now, this man was named Gordon Story. And on deposition, he said he was in control of the job. At the trial, he changed that stance and gave control to the base operator. The base operator was never good fine for deposition. And the record shows that the day before he gave evidence, which was the second day of the trial, was the first time that he had met the lawyer for the defense. Somehow he turned up after the first day of the trial was over, and he came that next day and said, I was in control of the whole job. The accident was all my fault. And that's what happened, of course, in the trial. And the fact that he met with the defense counsel the night before he gave his evidence for the first time is part of the record, too. So, in a sense, I guess, you can say either that the plaintiff's counsel was not diligent enough in uncovering these witnesses. You can say that the plaintiff's counsel was sandbagged by a last-minute witness who had not turned up. I really don't think that's relevant. What I do think is relevant is that...
Had you asked an interrogatory to name the witnesses, persons having knowledge of relevant facts?
Yes, sir.
Was this person named?
Yes, sir. I believe he was, but never produced. Never could be found.
Never could be found?
Yes, sir.
And then they shows up at the time of trial?
He apparently met with the defense counsel, and that shows in the record at page 158, statement of facts. He met the defense counsel the night before he gave evidence.
Well,
first night of the trial.
Who was the witness, though, you said changed his testimony at trial from what he'd given at deposition?
That was the witness. The one we were just talking about was Stewart, the Bates operator. The one who changed his testimony was named Story, who was the RV tool operator.
All right. And what point of error does this relate to what you're talking about now, whether you were sandbagged or the testimony got changed?
Well, this... I don't know if it relates to any of the points there.
You've got a sanctions point because they wouldn't let you call a witness you had not named 30 days in advance of trial. We didn't grant writ on that, but as Judge Ray says, it's before us. Then you've got a point of error on not allowing you to cross-examine to show bias and prejudice.
Right.
I want to know what this relates to that you have just told us about.
Well, I think it relates to the point on the settlement. That witness's evidence was, of course, the crucial evidence in the case. I'm not complaining about the fact that I didn't seek him out or maybe do what I should have done to get him deposed, because I think if I had done that, by the time I had gotten the deposition, he would have said the same thing he said at trial anyway. So I don't really know if it relates, if it's germane, as they say, to either point. But I'm trying to give this court a picture of what happened at the trial, is really what I'm trying to do, and to say that as was said in the City of Houston case, that this is not really a fair adversary proceeding for Martinez. But we have all kinds of rules here that Martinez is asked, a complex rule that Martinez is asked to bear the burden of, in my respectful submission. And what happened to him there was he got some evidence that was false. And there was no way for him to either explain that evidence by proper cross-examination about the settlement.
Yeah, I don't see this in any point of error you have in front of us, what you're talking about here. These other witnesses. And we're talking about your being precluded from showing bias and prejudice by virtue of the settlement.
Yes, sir.
That's one point. Your other point on which we did not grant was that you called a witness and the trial judge excluded the witness because you had not identified that witness within 30 days prior to trial.
Yes.
Now this other that you're talking about, I don't see what point of error it relates to. Maybe I'm obtuse, but I just don't see it.
Well, I think I said all I could say anyway.
Let me ask you this. Did you ask the trial judge to allow you to cross-examine Bates to prove up that perhaps he had a retro insurance agreement with Texas employers, something that would show his bias and his reason for testifying that it was all Bates's fault and not RV Tool's fault?
We did not ask the judge in those exact terms.
Did you ask Bates anything like that?
No, sir. Bates was not at the scene. Bates was...
Are the Bates witnesses, the employees of Bates, who accepted the responsibility for Bates, did you ask them any of that?
No, sir, and...
You know, I can see the potential prejudice here if, but it's not enough that I can see it as being possible. It's got to be in record. Now, what can you point to in the record by way of bill exceptions showing up the motivation for these people testifying as they did?
Did you make a bill?
Yes,
did you tend to the bill?
There was a on motion for a new trial. There was evidence brought before the court, and a settlement had been made. That was through the witness of the attorney, Alan McCall. And there was evidence given on the other point of error from the witness who was not called, not permitted to be called in the trial proper. It is in both those are in the supplemental statement of facts which were filed in the court of appeal. So in the record, that is really all I can point to now.
All right, that settlement agreement, you will concede, is not admissible unless it falls within an exception under the rules of evidence. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. One exception would be a showing of bias and prejudice in order to make the settlement agreement admissible. I'm just asking you to point to something in the record, either testimony that went before the court or just bill of exception, tending to show bias and prejudice on the part of the witnesses.
I told you it's in the supplemental statement of facts and the evidence of the witness in the call.
And what is that testimony?
It shows that there was a settlement on the workers' compensation.
Fine.
It shows that pages 3 and 4 of the supplemental statement.
Counsel, you talked about a sanctions point in response to District of Garland. I don't see any. You only have 2 points of error, did you not? I don't see anything.
Sanctions point, no.
In either point that you preserved error, that the trial court, that you were prejudiced in some way by the defendants not disclosing the witness and making them available on the eve of trial.
No, that was not in the record.
And that's not the word. So there's no point of error on that.
No, sir. I think I've said what I can say unless there are further questions from the court.
Well, all you've told me so far is you got in the record there was a settlement agreement. I'm asking you, can you point to somewhere in the record where you showed what motivation there was on the part of these witnesses to assume responsibility?
Well, the way I saw the case and still see it is that once there is evidence of a settlement made, it becomes more or less a matter of argument with the jury. In other words, if the settlement amounts to $50,000 and the claim is for $300,000, then I think it's a reasonable inference to show that the common owner of those two corporations would like to avoid the additional $250,000 claim.
But you don't have that in the record.
Well, with respect, sir, I think it would be a matter of argument based on the amount of the settlement and the amount of the claim.
The fact that Texas employers paid off a workers' compensation claim to Alberto Martinez, you want to be able to argue from that therefore the purchasers of the TEI policy were prejudiced or biased against Martinez. That's what you wanted to be able to argue to the jury.
I want to be able to argue that since Bates and RV Tool are commonly owned, and since Bates is already out of it for a fraction of the claim, if Bates can show that it is entirely responsible, then therefore they will avoid the claim by taking responsibility. That's what I want.
You're telling us that now. Is there anything in the record that will support that?
Just my argument to the judge on the motion.
We will hear from respondent.
Mr. Trotter will present argument for the respondent.
May I please the court, as introduced, my name is Jason Trotter. Along with Perry Davis, we represent the respondent in this case, RV Tool. And as the court has questioned Mr. Jocko rather extensively regarding the evidence on the points he has raised, I think I'll make an attempt to clear up some of the discrepancies. I think the record is fairly clear that at the time the co-owner for Bates Well Service and RV Tool was called to testify, Mr. Larry Bates, that Mr. Jocko and his co-counsel were given every opportunity to develop the relationship between Bates Well Service and RV Tool, their ownership interests in each of the companies, and the relationship between the two witnesses that would testify on behalf of the defendant. I believe at the time that Mr. Stewart was called to testify, there was no attempt made to prove up by way of bill of exception outside of the presence of the jury to show that maybe at some point that he would have some reason to get up and fabricate his testimony. By the same token, at the time Mr. Story was called to testify, again, there was no attempt by the counsel for Mr. Martinez to elicit any testimony from him to show that he might be biased or prejudiced and in some way attempt to fabricate his testimony. The only bill of exception that was prepared was offered at the time the plaintiff filed his motion for new trial, which was some 2.5 months, the hearing on the motion was some 2.5 months after judgment. At that time, the only evidence which was offered by way of the bill was testimony from the attorney for the intervener. The testimony, very briefly, just simply stated the terms of the comp settlement, the amount of comp that was paid to Mr. Martinez, and the amount of medical that was tendered by TEIA to Mr. Martinez.
Out of curiosity, and I'm sure it's not in the record, we know the TEIA was the intervener here.
Yes, sir.
All right. Who is the insurance carrier for RV2?
TEIA. Apparently, I would just assume that...
Was there any effort to get that in the record? Is that in the record, that the insurance carrier for RV2 was TEIA?
No, sir. There was no attempt.
Was it TEIA or Employers Casualty?
TEIA. As I understand, they're all...
That's all part of one group.
The same company. But there was no attempt, Justice Bill Garland, to show that the defendant, RV2, was insured by the same company as the employer for Mr. Martinez. There's no evidence in the record to that effect. The only evidence to show that there was any type of coverage for the comp carrier was shown on the bill of exception of the motion for new trial. And that was just a brief testimony by the attorney for the intervener, Mr. McFall.
Someday when we're not in argument here, you'll have to explain to me why TEIA intervened to recover from itself.
Well, that is unusual. It would seem that, and it's quite obvious that had they not received recovery verdict in this case, that they should have had the opportunity to recoup some of the money that they had paid Mr. Martinez. And again, as Mr. Jocko had made reference to, as far as the testimony of Mr. Stewart, who was the person in charge of the Bates crew at the scene at the time this accident occurred, his name was earnest and responsive in interrogatories in a timely fashion. He appeared at trial, but simply there was no request by Mr. Jocko or his co-counsel to have him produced for deposition. Mr. Stewart was always employed by Bates Well Service. He could have been produced for deposition at any time. And the point of error raised by Mr. Jocko concerning the admissibility of the settlement agreement is his contention that the admissibility of the workers' compensation settlement would have showed some bias or prejudice on the part of the witnesses called by the defendant. The witnesses that were called, as the record will reflect, were Larry Bates. Mr. Bates is the co-owner of RV2 along with his father, the co-owner of Bates Well Service. As I previously mentioned, Mr. Jocko was allowed to prove up the relationship between the parties. The other two witnesses, Mr. Stewart, who was an employee of Bates Well Service, and in fact was the operator of the rig, and I believe the testimony reflects that it was his responsibility to make sure that these clamps were removed from the collars. Mr. Jocko has made references to the fact that Mr. Story, who testified, who part of his deposition was admitted into evidence, and then he testified live, that he altered his testimony. I believe a close examination of the record will reflect that his testimony did not alter. It was always his testimony that he took his orders from the company man. And it was his testimony that Mr. Stewart was responsible for removing the collars. And that was, again, with Mr. Stewart's testimony. So there was really not any inconsistency in the testimony between those two witnesses. As far as the law is concerned with the admissibility of the settlement agreement, there is a long line of cases in Texas regarding the admissibility of a workers' compensation settlement. The cases have held for many years that the admissibility of the evidence would be reversible error. It's not material to any of the issues of liability in a third-party action. The cases have held, they would simply just confuse and mislead the jury on the claims before the court. Because the third-party liability action, being a negligence case and a compensation case, which are two different types of claims, they involve different rules of liability and different rules of damages. And it's just simply our position that had that workers' compensation settlement agreement been introduced, it would probably just confuse the jury on the issues before them, that being the negligence, if any, on the part of the defendant RV Pool. If you examine the cases in Texas on this question, it's interesting to note that every case where there was an attempt to introduce the comp settlement, the attempt was made on behalf of the defendants. And the cases where the testimony or the evidence was admitted either by way of live testimony or pleadings which were filed by the intervener in the case, if the testimony or the pleadings were admitted, each case was reversed on this principle.
You really don't want to stick with that argument, do you? I mean, you got a lot better arguments of why the comp settlement should not have been admitted, but isn't the underlying reason for that rule is keep the jury from being prejudiced by the fact that the claimant has already recovered money in a comp claim, and therefore they need not award him in a third-party claim?
I would agree with that, and I think the case and the rule are cut both ways. Simply, and I believe fruitfully, if anyone would want to introduce the settlement agreement, it would be the defendant. He simply prejudiced the plaintiff to show that he has received some compensation in the past, that he has had some medical expenses paid. And I think the cases, partially the holdings, would be to the benefit of the plaintiff so that it would not prejudice him in that way.
This is just a part of our collateral source rule, isn't it?
Certainly. The case relied on by petitioner in his brief on this point is the City of Houston versus Wallace case. That is a case involving the interpretation of a Mary Carter agreement. The facts are very strange. Apparently the City of Houston and Wallace and co-plaintiff had secretly entered into a settlement agreement prior to the submission of the case to the jury. And this is without any knowledge to the City of Houston. So at the time jury arguments commenced, the attorney for Wallace Company got up and tried to push the blame off on the City of Houston, much to their surprise. Apparently the first time that the attorneys for the City of Houston were aware that any type of settlement agreement had been made was approximately a week later, when a judgment was being forwarded to all counsel for approval. That case involved the Mary Carter agreement, and it is our position that if you take this compromise settlement agreement involving the petitioner in this case and the workers' compensation carrier for Bankwell Service, Texas employers, that there's really not any logical way that you could equate that or parallel that with the Mary Carter agreement. Because if the Mary Carter principle is to apply, it's clear that the plaintiff in the case must settle with a defendant to that case, and also that defendant must retain some type of financial interest in the plaintiff's recovery. So if you look at the settlement agreement, it's clear that the comp settlement was made with petitioner and Texas Employers, who was a comp carrier for Bates Well Service, and that was made in a separate lawsuit. Texas Employers was a party to this case, but they were, in the sense of the word, aligned with the interests of the plaintiff. They were not a co-defendant. So they cannot be considered, under the Mary Carter principle, to be a settling defendant for the purposes of applying this principle. And also, under the holding of Scurlock, which Justice Kilgore, I'm aware of, he wrote the opinion,
even if this comp settlement agreement were to be construed as a merit order, it could not be admissible under that holding because it is not a settlement agreement between the identical parties from a prior proceeding. RB Tool was not a party to the comp settlement. They were not a party to that case. They did not sign the agreement. No one from RB Tool signed the agreement. The agreement was entered into between TDIA and Mr. Martinez. So even if that principle were to apply, I just don't see how the logical parallel could be used to admit evidence of that comp settlement under that principle. And I believe Mr. Jocko's last point on this particular area would be that the admissibility of this evidence would in some way serve to show bias or interest on the part of the witnesses. We all know this case is tried to the jury, and the jury is a fact finder and judges the credibility of the witnesses. They can leave all part or none of the testimony from any witness that they hear, including any type of exhibit that is introduced. The witnesses, all the witnesses were called live. They had an opportunity to listen to their testimony to observe their demeanor. And if for some reason they chose not to believe any testimony in this case, or if they chose or concluded that Mr. Stewart was in some way fabricating his testimony, they could have disregarded his testimony and found RB2 was false. So I just do not think that the admissibility of his comp settlement would have assisted the jury in any way. I think it would only confuse them. And it is our position that the evidence was properly excluded and that the Court of Appeals correctly affirmed the ruling on the trial court on that point.
Counsel, assuming your distinction that the Scurlock versus Smithwick case is a valid one, and I don't accept that totally,
yes.
As you know I wrote in Scurlock, how do you rationalize the provisions of the Texas Rules of Evidence 408, which provide that a settlement that information about a settlement is admissible to prevent a false and misleading portrayal to a jury?
The exception to the rule.
Yes. I'm not sure why that doesn't apply. Now, there's another hurdle to get over. Is there evidence of the record to show it? I'm not sure there is. There's some doubt about it based on counsel's answers. But why wouldn't that apply in a situation like this, assuming evidence were present?
Well, Justice Pierce, there's always been my interpretation of the rule, how am I being correct, that rule applies to the parties of the case. And
why don't you restrict it to parties to the cases? If it's going to show bias or prejudice, does it make any difference to us between you? Isn't that just a mechanical thing? You say what has to be between the parties?
Well, I guess so.
I see no reason to restrict it. I'm asking you if there is a reason.
And except it's absolutely just if that situation were to apply.
Yeah.
So if
suddenly
happened in front of another case,
they
just confused the jury.
Well, sure wouldn't have confused them here. They'd have figured it out in the New York way. Why there was the complicity between the insurance company and the family. You'd let that evidence in, they'd know exactly what was happening, wouldn't they? Wouldn't that have made a fair trial?
Jury was in the dark here. They didn't know why one was blaming it out on the other one. It's a very good reason for it, but they didn't know it.
Well, that's assuming that the
witnesses were fabricating their
testimony. No, I don't think they were fabricating it.
They were being perfectly candid about it.
But they were doing it for a reason, weren't they?
Yes, sir. I think
disregarding the
exception,
the jury was aware of the fact that Bates Wilson was not a part of the case. Under the earlier case, we could not admit an issue of their negligence to the jury. And so, the jury, by concluding or accepting Mr. Stewart's testimony as accurate, found no fault on behalf of RB Tool. So, even though the evidence was not admitted, I think the jury became aware of the fact that even if this person had a reason to fabricate his testimony and exonerate RB Tool, had they chose not to accept the testimony, they could have sent all of this RB Tool.
Thank you.
Overall, we feel that the record states for itself.
Let me know. as I said, no evidence against the trial court. There's no evidence in the record to show what kind of bias or prejudice would have been presented as evidence in his court. Or, for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. We feel
that the opinion of the Court of Appeals represents the results. We feel the trial court had acted properly in excluding the evidence.
You said earlier that you felt this was the type of evidence that would ordinarily help the defendant for it to come in.
Yes, sir.
So,
did you favor this evidence coming in this trial, or did you oppose it?
Well, we oppose the evidence simply for three reasons.
By following
the cases in the state.
And
we look at it as kind of a two-edged sword. We offer the evidence of the final settlement agreement to the court and have the court allow it in. And it would have been a reversible error in the case.
And
by the same token, had Kushner entered his evidence, and
he would have made
a favorable judgment, then there would have been a reversible error.
Well, wait a minute. He offers it, and you don't object. There's not going to be any error.
Well, we would have objected to it.
Well, I was just trying to understand that. And if it goes back for another trial, you'll object to it again. Because by your, is that correct?
Yes.
Because by your answer to Judge Kilgarland, I was hearing me that you wanted this in evidence, in which case there's no conflict between the parties.
But
I guess I misheard that.
I was just making the observation that if the act were admissible and if a party in the case, if there was a party who would really want to have the evidence presented, it would be or the prejudicial effect would possibly have on the plaintiff.
It's just standing on the principle of preserving this stuff. The integrity of the law, not living with him, even if it would be helpful to you.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not presupposing that bias and prejudice were shown by those exceptions. As a matter of fact, it seems to the contrary here. But assuming they were shown,
don't you
think Rule 408 of the Rules of Evidence clearly
would allow
the settlement agreement to be admitted
if it did turn
to show bias and
prejudice? If there were evidence in the record?
Yeah.
We're reading the rule, I would have to agree. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I would like to thank the court for its time and consideration. If there are no further questions, that would conclude my presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, it seems so far that we're all agreed that there's an absence in the record of what kind of evidence that I really needed in order to properly pursue this appeal. And I want to right now just briefly say that I don't think that that's the case. I submit that if we were to put in the evidence of the settlement agreement and the evidence of the common ownership, which the trial judge did permit, but which did simply not go far enough to let us make the natural argument that flows from that. That is, here are two companies owned together by the same man. He was not at the scene and can't tell us what happened. Here are Story and Stewart, his employees. One works for one company, one works for the other. They are both saying that the settling party who's paid $50,000 on this $300,000 claim is at fault. It's over for Bates. That's why.
that's your problem in your attempted logical deduction there. The settling party was TEIA. Settling party was not Bates Well Service.
Well,
so you have to leap from the settlement by TEIA to try to impute bias on Bates.
Well,
and that's why I want to find out what in the record did you have to tie it up?
We did not try to introduce evidence that there was a common insurer for both companies. I have to tell you that we didn't try to do that. I hope it doesn't sink the appeal from our team, but that's the way it is. What we tried to show we tried even to, I guess, to skate around, probably too softly, to skate around the insurance problem. At the same time, we wanted to introduce enough evidence for us to make an argument to the jury that there was some reason for these people to be motivated to say what they did.
All right, so you get in front of the jury. Let's say you get in front of the jury. TEIA settled the work claim of Martinez. Let's say you're able to get that in front of the jury.
As the insurer for Bates, yeah.
As the insured for Bates.
Right. And then the argument to the jury is that now Bates is out of the case completely. They can never be compelled to pay more money.
And Bates was out of the case when they bought a policy of comp insurance.
There you have it. The jury didn't know that. The jury didn't know that Bates was out of the case. In fact, their findings were that Harvey Poole was not negligent and Martinez was not negligent. That only left Bates in my respectful submission. The jury made a finding that Bates was responsible for this accident by inference. So they obviously believed what these witnesses said. And I agree with you, this is not, the facts are simple, but it's sort of complex because we have to apparently fly in the face of a lot of case law, which has to go towards the policy of promoting settlements in cases. But as you heard from Mr. Trotter, he is the one, he's the reason we're here. His opposition to the introduction of this evidence is the reason we're here. Normally, I would be the one who would be opposed to this evidence. But in this situation, as a matter of getting the trial done and getting to the truth of what happened, it became obvious early on that we would have to try to be able to show that the witnesses, Story and Stewart, were motivated to assist Bates and his insurers for whatever reason. And with respect, sir, I don't think we should, I think we can properly argue that to a jury without going into the details of the common insurers or the increase in premium for Bates. I think it would be clear to the jury if they heard, yes, there was a settlement for Bates, and I wouldn't mind the amount of the settlement were in evidence, because that gives you the argument, well, we're getting out for a fraction of what was claimed. The jury believes the claim is valid. In this particular case, they don't know, unless they know the amount, what Bates has paid. It does cut two ways, too, because we could find ourselves in a position where the jury would think this man had been paid enough by Bates. It was not a decision which would, to introduce this evidence is not a decision which would only necessarily benefit the claimant. We would have preferred the case to have been done that way from the start, before we knew the result. And I think what I'm really asking the court to do is give us a chance to do that, to do it right, and see that Martinez, in this situation gets a fair and fair proceed. Really all I'm asking. I know that the entire case, I learned today that the entire case is here before the court, and so I have a couple of final remarks on the second point, which writ was not granted. In addition to facing this obstacle and trying to explain what happened to the jury, we brought a witness by the name of Malone, his testimony from the Supplemental Statement of Facts, which is a little thin volume of the other. The witness was an expert and worked in the oil fields for 23 years. He also had worked for Bates Flood Service Company, and knew, had actual knowledge, not expert opinion knowledge, actual knowledge of the way RV Tool operated.
Is his testimony preserved by way of bill exception?
Yes, sir. Well, motion for new trial.
But it was not offered until the motion for new trial. It was not offered during the trial.
But before it went to the jury, We asked the judge specifically to bring that evidence, and we're denied.
Did you outline the testimony?
Yes, sir. It was outlined in the motion to him before the jury.
All right.
Went out.
And what reason did you give to the judge as good cause as to why that witness's testimony should be allowed?
I didn't give any, but I didn't have any.
Well, you just named him late.
Yes, sir.
And you sought to call him, and the judge says, no, you can't call him. Doesn't Rule 215-5 clearly say that the burden is on you to show good cause of why the witness ought to have been permitted to testify, even though he wasn't timely made?
And so far as he is an expert witness, yes, sir. But we've tendered him for two purposes. One is that he gave expert evidence of how it was always done in the oil field. The other reason was he gave direct evidence from his experience working with Bates that this is the way Bates and RV operated their system. So he gave two kinds of evidence. And in the Gannett outdoor case, which is cited in the brief, Court of Appeals, I think in Houston, made a ruling.
You're talking about Gannett outdoor advertising versus Kubetska?
Yeah, I believe that's the defendant.
Yeah, but that's when they caught the insurance, the signboard company lying, and they permitted this rebuttal witness to testify. And the good cause in that case was they had the right to assume that the sign company would tell the truth, and when they didn't tell the truth, then that certainly gave rise to their calling a rebuttal witness.
Yes, sir, but I believe the case also turned on the fact that the expert was a rebuttal fact witness, not an expert who had to be identified prior to trial. In other words, Martinez, after we got stuck in a hole there where we couldn't introduce the settlement agreement, then we tried to bring somebody to say, well, this is the way RV Tool and Bates always do it, exactly contrary to the way that the witness, historian Stewart, testified, and the judge said, well, he's an expert, you haven't given 30 days notice, and so he can't testify. And it was argued to him that he was an actual employee of, had been, of Bates Well Service, and could testify about their practices specifically as a fact witness, not as an opinion evidence, and that evidence went out too, so the jury didn't have the benefit of that either. And so Martinez, when the case went to the jury without any talk of settlement, other than the common ownership, pure and simple. No argument was allowed that could flow from that, and no other part of the settlement was before the jury. No argument about it. Then we brought this, the witness who worked for Bates, and he was not allowed either. And I submit the net result was that maybe partially our fault in the way we handled the trial and making these decisions, the strategy as we went along. But Martinez should not suffer for it, and he should have a fair trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your attention.
The court will take a brief recess.
Yeah.